Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, Maddie.
How's it going?
Excellent.
We haven't done a TNT in a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
TNT, new tough, right? I think we should be doing more of them.
Mm-hmm.
Conversations are important.
Absolutely. There's a lot to get out.
You brought a guest?
I did. Jennifer. Jennifer, hi. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for being a part of this. I understand, you know, how overwhelming it can be to, like, hey, walk into a place, sit down, start talking, and we're here to illuminate you. You've got so much to share to the world. You've experienced so many different things. You've lived, breathed so many different areas of construction of life, and you have so much to offer. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
What's the Kevin Bacon thing? How did you guys meet?
So great question. I had the pleasure of meeting Jennifer within the past 6 months of doing some coaching work at Faro.
Oh, right? So Faro International.
Faro International.
Modular. Yeah.
Modular. And I'm going to tell you, like, the day I met Jennifer, the energy was different. I felt really connected, really engaged, such an intelligent human being. So thank you. Humble, curious, and continues to experience things in life and share them. And Jennifer can share her story on how she sort of stumbled into this, the space that she's into now, because it wasn't always that way. And I got enamored with some of her passions of horses, which hopefully we can talk a bit more about that. And one thing that brought us here today was the resilience that Jennifer's demonstrated and experienced in the past few months that sort of pulled on every single heartstring. And I was sitting
the end of 24 and the beginning of 25.
Yeah, like 2024 was a year on its own. But then in 2025, we thought we had a path that was going to be a little hard. But then it just all changed in January and it just...
Let's pivot right to you. I mean, you know, say hello world.
Yeah.
and start sharing your story. Like, where did you start and how did you end up at Faro? Because I think that's very important to set the context.
Of course. We'll do a quick summary of my life, I guess. So I grew up in the Netherlands in Europe. I was just a typical student there. I was really set on either going into the medical field towards veterinarian or towards like a kinesiology kind of field in the human side of things. We grew up on a farm, so I was always tinkering about in the farm. But I grew up there, and then we moved to Canada when I was in grade 12.
So 18-ish?
17, yeah.
17, okay, yeah.
And so my parents moved. I wasn't too happy about it as a 17-year-old that... had a life in the Netherlands that I was happy with.
And that would have been what, the 2000 and something or 2000?
Yeah, we moved in December of 2011.
Okay.
We moved to Ancaster here in Ontario.
Netherlands to Ancaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be happy either.
And I went into high school and I thought I was laughing because I was like, oh, all of these Hollywood movies are true. High school here is very different than high school in Europe. But at that point... I didn't really know anyone, so I met a guy named Frank, who was a little Italian guy, who went to the engineering experience weekend at Mac, at which point was when he came back, he starts talking about it. That was actually the first time I'd heard the word engineering, or had anyone ever mentioned it to me. I was very strong in the science fields within high school, but that's not something that anyone ever considered.
Was it the design aspect of engineering or the structural aspect of engineering that appealed to you at first?
I'd say both, but particularly because I was always tinkering about. I was always fixing things on the farm, on improving things, making things easier. It becomes a family business when you
problem
have a farm.
Solving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then I did the very last minute switch and swapped my program from kinesiology to engineering. I went to Mac in Hamilton and had a great time.
It's a good school.
Yeah.
It's a great school, yeah.
Because I still wanted to incorporate some of that biology and human aspect, I ended up going into mechanical engineering with the focus of it potentially going into biomechanical later on. My grandfather also only has one leg, so the prosthetic aspect really intrigued me as well. Turns out that even prosthetics have structural aspects.
And yeah, they do.
I like structure a lot more than moving parts and heat transfer and things like that. So then I transferred from mechanical to civil engineering, focusing on structural, and did a co-op for Elliston, then was hired on full-time for Elliston.
Wow.
spent some time in Toronto building condos. The
boxes in the sky.
Yeah, that net zero carbon project at Mohawk, which was really, really neat.
Oh, yeah.
Was my first kind of interaction with the sustainability and the, I guess, the more R&D side of construction.
I'm curious, at that point, did you reference the Netherlands and Europe compared to what they were doing sustainability-wise and sustainability here?
So at the same time as that was going on, my hometown was building a cradle-to-cradle city hall. So kind of really utilizing the concept of like passive housing, as well as recycling materials, recycling everything that you can think of, going from air to water to everything that this building uses, to be able to build it in the most sustainable fashion, which is a little bit easier in the Netherlands than it is in Canada, climate-wise.
Yeah.
But it's something that really piqued my interest. And then going back to doing condos in Toronto, not quite as exciting.
Boxes in the sky. Yeah. That's what I mean, yeah.
So at that point, Ellis Dawn set up their Ellis Dawn modular facility in Stony Creek.
Yeah, which would have been the precursor to Farrell.
Yeah, and I lived in Hamilton at the time, so it was a logistically for myself an easier spot to work from as well. And then in September of 2023, that's the spot that Farrow took over.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up at Farrow, and then eventually meeting Jonathan.
And you've been coaching at Farrow.
Since November, yeah. So it's been 6 months, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Jennifer, the space she occupies today is project management, which is cool. I mean, that also excites me with my background. But I got really intrigued when she talked about engineering because, you know, my brain went to like, okay, stereotypical traditional engineer. Jennifer is not, because the way she described it was she saw something different. Very pragmatic, yes. Very detail-oriented, numbers-oriented. Like, Jennifer likes to figure out things. This is true. Okay, so if this is true, but then she brings forth a human aspect of it, what she described. And that's really what intrigued me too, because she brings it to her workforce today.
Yeah, and then that part I'm really grateful. I did the engineering and society program at Mac.
Yeah.
Society is a 1 year add-on that allows you to do more additional classes. Like I took a bunch of classes to get a minor in sustainability. But it also had some engineering specific classes that were taught by certain professors that are very passionate about there being more to engineering. Yes, engineering is very science-based, but there's a connection between the people and society and the science. You need to have people that can talk about it and transfer the knowledge to the general public so they have, as stakeholders in many projects, have a better understanding of what is actually happening and are things happening in their favor. Because if you just talk technical to them, they might not understand because they're not trained to understand that. And a lot of engineers lack that communication ability. So being able to participate in a program that really emphasized that that connection part and making sure that no matter what, you're doing good and talking about developing soft skills and other aspects that we just don't typically have the time to develop in university when you're only focused on the technical aspects.
The communication side of engineering that doesn't get taught enough and doesn't get explored enough, right? So, which is interesting. That's something that Jennifer really brings to the table. And she takes it into the workspace she's in today. And can we bring something else into the equation that I think is really important? You've never lost connection with sort of your hometown roots. You've always thought about that. You and I have often talked about the difference in ideologies between this culture versus, you know, the culture in the Netherlands, where people would simply, I think you described it as people tell you the truth. Like, they just say shit the way it is, right? And here we're too soft about, I have to make sure that I frame it properly so I don't upset you. And you're saying there's something very different when you tell somebody straight, because then you can get to the root cause of the issue and solve a problem.
Yes, that's very correct. But there is a balance there as well. When you're talking, you should be talking factual when you're just saying it boldly. Otherwise, you're being rude. And that doesn't help anyone either.
Right.
If you're just being rude, no one's going to pay attention to you because they're already annoyed with you for the fact that you're being rude no matter what you're saying. So you have to incorporate some of those soft skills and find that balance, in my opinion, between the Canadian culture and that blunt European culture. There's a nice middle road there, which I think is very effective in communication.
Mm. So, you know, what have you found to sort of marry the two that works for you?
That there's a difference between unsolicited advice and constructive criticism.
What do you mean by that?
That
in the schooling or on the site?
In every aspect.
Every aspect?
Yeah. Like if I'm, especially when I started construction, I was just turned 20. I come onto this job site with people that have, mostly men, have significantly more experience than me. So if I get a task given to me by the project manager, and I communicate that to the trades and I tell them what to do, they're going to just by point zero be upset the fact that I'm going there telling them what to do, because who am I? But then if I talk to them and I'm like, okay, what are you doing? This is what they've asked me to do. How can we get there together? I see that you're doing this. Would you be open to trying this to be able to get that result? It's a better communication because it starts off at an easier point.
It's a collaborative effort. Yeah. I've always done that in construction.
Yeah.
You never, even though if you're the top dog, so to speak, I've never had to pull out the stripes on my sleeve or whatever. It was just about, here's the job, here's the project, here's the scope. How do we collaborate? How do I pick your brain, learn from you, and vice versa? Mm-hmm. I think that goes a lot further on a job site or on a project, any project.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
But there are parts in, and I'd say in Europe more so than here, where the blue collar trades are looked down upon in comparison to people that like me that have an engineering degree.
Here or there?
There, more so than here.
Really?
People here kind of glorify Europe a little bit. So that surprised me in a positive sense. That the trades are more respected here. And everything is built on mutual respect. And it's, because there they come and they're like, I've been to university, which is like this top goal for everyone. And therefore, I'm better than you. And that's wrong.
Yeah, that's just 100% wrong.
Okay, so take us through the rest of that story. So now you're working with Ellis Don. You step on a condo. This was the first sort of projects you were part of. Is that accurate?
It's the second, like the first one I, as a full-time
condo.
Yeah.
Okay, so that lasts for how long?
So these were three mid-rise buildings.
Yep.
I was there for 3 years, but they weren't done yet. So one and a half of the three had occupancy when I left. But there was COVID in between, so the project was a little bit delayed.
Yeah.
So you're working at what capacity there at that point in time?
I was a project coordinator.
You're a project coordinator, so you had a bunch of people around you sort of guiding you, coaching you along the way, taking you through the whole
realm. And you're 21 at the time?
22. Yeah. And we had one project manager, one other project coordinator, and three towers in the time of COVID. It was not an easy project, and it was kind of sink or swim for me to be able to adapt and work there.
In all fairness, though, Jen, I mean, that's intimidating for anybody.
Yes.
At that age, going on the job site and having those three projects and then mix in COVID at the time as well, too. That's intimidation for everybody.
It was a tough time to start. And everyone comes and they're like, in my 30 years, in my 40 years, I've never seen this. And I'm like, well, I'm in my first year. And I'm
great. Here's a pair of glasses. This.
What do you take away from that? Like, what do you learn of yourself at that period of time?
That it doesn't matter how little you know when no one else knows what's going on either.
Oh.
Like, in a way, it balanced it a little bit.
It's true. I like that.
Because we were all just figuring it out together.
Yeah.
Right.
And it broke that barrier a little bit.
So then the modular aspect comes into play. And that was simply a logistical thing. Hey, it's closer to home. I'm going to try this. Like, what intrigued you?
That, and I wanted to get out of condos. I didn't. I liked the challenge. I learned a lot. I got to experience a lot of different trades. For a longer period of time, like elevators is not something we typically do in modular. So I'm happy that I got a better understanding of that and things that were associated with it. But also the limits and the issues of traditional construction, especially in a city like Toronto. And it's a lot of it, I kept thinking there must be a better way. Like we had issues for trade parking.
There isn't any.
Exactly.
Meet Jonathan Sinelli, the visionary behind People First Leadership. Jonathan is not your average leadership coach. His People First Leadership approach focuses on putting people at the core of your strategy, creating workplaces where teams thrive and achieve outstanding results. What sets him apart? Jonathan is a master at asking thought-provoking questions that spark genuine conversations and challenge conventional thinking. His deep empathy helps him understand unique challenges and guide people toward impactful solutions. As an accomplished author, media host of the People First podcast, and seasoned project management expert with a background as an electrician, Jonathan offers unparalleled experience and practical insights. Whether you're interested in a one-on-one coaching or breakout room sessions, Jonathan customizes his approach to your needs. He also travels the world, speaking at conferences and business events, inspiring leaders with his dynamic presentations. Discover how People First Leadership can transform your approach and ignite your team's potential with Jonathan Sinelli. Call Jonathan at 416-717-4139 or email him at jc@jonathansinelli.com or reach out to him on his website at jonathansinelli.com. This message is proudly supported by the Construction Life Podcast. It doesn't exist.
And then bringing in your cranes, and then you have your you have to pay the houses that the crane might be passing over, if for whatever reason, if you have a luffer or a hammer, and the ratios, then oh, there's metro links there. Everywhere are constraints.
There's a float. Issues. There's a floater for every building that crane is towering over. That in the event they damage that building or that house, that it comes out of that float. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
And they got safety nets in certain areas. I don't know if you experienced the safety nets. It gets, and if you're a homeowner, well, I've seen some homeowners really
kind of
take advantage of the situation sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, like, we had to bring in hydro. In order to do that, Toronto was running out of hydro. So then we had to tear up the road. We had to do this. We had to do that. There's so much disruption to the communities that I understand why they're all pissed off at construction.
Ooh.
So then there must be a better way.
There's no forward thinking.
No.
If you're already excavating for one thing, for one project, and you're already opening up, whether it's a one-way road or a two-way road, why not already start to build the infrastructure in there for a future project if you already know that? We know the city does this all the time.
Exactly.
They'll just do the task at hand and whatever's been permitted for that structure on that lot.
Yeah.
They don't factor in that in 6 months, that lot next to it is going to be digging the same roadway, causing the same congestion, when it could all be done right now.
Yep. And that modular is the same way of thinking, because as they're digging and disrupting and prepping the foundation, we're building the buildings in our factory. Mm. And in the end, they get installed there, but the drywall's already in there. The painting is, like, everything is already done. So the finish time on site gets reduced so much. And all that time that we don't spend on site, we're not disrupting the communities. We don't have to find parking for our trades, because our factory has plenty of parking. And the trades can work no matter the weather because we're building inside. There's no delays there. And then we go on site, place our building, connect it all, commission it, and now people have access.
Isn't there, you tell me, but I don't know if this is true or whatever, but wouldn't it make sense to create a utility modular unit that you excavate, drop it right in, and it holds all the utilities in one area? And then you just plug it in, connect it, for the structure that's being built, but in the future you can plug in future buildings into that same hub.
You're talking like a C-CAM with a whole bunch of hydro, you know, electrical equipment inside.
Yeah, but the traditional way of excavating and getting utilities to a structure is whether it's a suck back, you know, you're kind of removing all the earth, and then you're getting to the cabling or whatever, the waterworks, all that stuff, and then you patch it in that way. But why can't you build a modular unit that just is like, it just dumps right into the ground and it has all the components that you need to...
And that becomes your hub.
There's a couple different things, because yes, it is possible. It depends on the needs of the site. So certain buildings, they're existing buildings with existing meters that we have to hook into. So we did a classroom project where they ended up dropping an extra transformer on the exterior, but everything was still in our mechanical room in our building. Mm. So we just had to connect to that transformer. Or up north where we had a lot of heat done through geothermal for heating and cooling. So then, of course, they had to run the geothermal underground, because that's the only way to do it. But then when we got there, we hooked up, and that was all we needed to do, because our equipment was already set up and pre-tested. So once we got there, we just had to connect, commission, and good to go.
But isn't that how electrical in Europe is done? They do it by points of hub, and then it's branched off. Instead of here in North America, we're doing a whole run for one particular fixture, right?
A lot of it, yeah.
Yeah, which I like the European way of doing it, because now you could just branch off these different hubs in different areas of the structure.
Yes, and you're also less affected by things like power outages.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never had a power outage going up, or, well, one time when our house got hit by lightning.
That
direct cause and effect. Whereas in, I remember moving to Ontario, and then there was like, oh, the power's out, it'll come back. I'm like, power's out? Like, why is, they're like, oh, like a line went down. I'm like, why are the lines above the ground? Why is the tree falling?
I know. They should all be buried. I know, under frost line. So they'd never be disturbed.
It's a lot easier to do in a country that's one third the size of Vancouver Island compared to the size of Canada. But perhaps in areas like the GTA, that should all be buried.
Mm. So I want to pivot back to something quickly here. Because today when you're with Infero, what do you think that you, the biggest thing you take from your experience working in that condo situation with Ellis Dawn, with all those parameters you talked about, that you take into the Infero world?
I think the ability to adapt. So for modular to be efficient, we have to have our design basically 100% done before we start building,
mm-hmm.
or we lose the efficiency of time. Whereas in conventional construction, of course, we start building when we're not 100% done yet, because it's, especially with the scope of things, like we can start excavating, we can start doing the foundation scope, because we still have to do two parking garages before we even get to a ground level. So who cares about the millwork finishes when we're still doing concrete for a while? Whereas in modular, that's not the case. We have to think about everything beforehand. But that's hard. And humans, no matter how good the consultants are, tend to miss a few things.
But human beings are notorious for changing things, too.
Exactly. So then you need a bit of client buy-in to be able to nail things down and not change it. But also just the sheer experience of the trades, being able to get certain changes go through in a matter of hours or days, whereas in conventional, it would take a week to get the RFI answer, then another, I don't know, month to get to change order issued. All of that time is something we don't have in modular. So being able to see that it can go quicker, and it doesn't actually diminish the quality of the work. It's because you have the buy-in from our client to get things turned around quickly, from the consultants to get things turned around quickly, and people are touching base with the trades at the get-go about how can we make this better, how can we do this, because this detail doesn't currently work. How do you think we can make this work? And being able to collaborate that almost instantly is something that gives us a massive advantage compared to conventional construction.
So it sounds like it almost forecasts you to think differently and call action. Okay, folks, so this isn't working. What do we do next?
Correct.
Which doesn't always occur in traditional construction. And then the ripple effect, of course, is stress, anxiety, pressure, breakdowns because shit's not happening fast enough,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is very different than the way that you're describing it.
Yeah, and it's a lot of that goes into the mechanical and electrical trades. We have very little ceiling space. Everything has to go in like a Tetris puzzle or it's not going to fit. In order to do that, those trades have to get along. They have to communicate. They have to collaborate. Whereas in conventional, oftentimes, we have a lot of space, so it doesn't matter if someone goes a little rogue. Whereas in modular, if someone goes rogue, there's a problem. They have to follow the drawings, and if they don't follow the drawings, they have to flag it immediately.
Do you see the innovation in traditional construction here in Canada?
I see the possibility of innovation.
Yeah, I see the same thing.
But I see a lot of hesitancy towards implementing it. And part of that might be because it's been okay. Like if you look at countries like Europe that are running out of space, they are forced to innovate because they don't have another choice.
Yeah, we have too much space.
And people love the status quo and don't like change.
Well, things get built faster. Things get approved sooner if you don't veer off the path too much.
Exactly.
But that's not innovative.
No.
That's actually missed opportunities.
And that requires a change of the mindset of everyone that's involved, from the stakeholder process. Because if the people that are paying for the work are fine with the way it is, nothing is going to change.
What happened to the expo? You remember the expo growing up? Like, didn't we have expos every year that they were foretelling the future, what the potential future city would be like? Like, that doesn't exist anymore, does it? And I bring that up because wouldn't it be kind of interesting with Canada being the first country that created the first sustainable home in Saskatchewan back in the 70s? We never built off of that for whatever reason, right? I can blame politicians. But why can't we look at a piece of land in Canada and go, listen, we're going to build a future city here. And all the innovations that we're considering for future homes, put it there, let people walk around in those homes and experience those homes, and then say, you know what? I'd like to have a lot of that stuff in my future home. Mm-hmm. But we're not doing that. Mm. We should be. It's almost like, what was that event in high school when you had science fair? It was a science fair?
Science fair where you walk around and you check out. Yeah.
I did a volcano, obviously. The trick with
remember those boards that were fold out?
Yeah. You always did the little diorama, whatever.
Yeah, science fairs.
And where is that? Like, why can't we have science fairs for construction where this is what I'm thinking about?
Especially, there's so many people with such brilliant ideas and nowhere to take them.
Or they're afraid to present them because...
Who's going to care?
Yeah. Which is a shame. It's a missed opportunity.
100%.
Well, it goes back to what you're saying. Is the fear mongering of like, hey, I don't like change. So I'm not going to... I'm sitting here going to flip the script in the way it's always been done and take the leap of faith, because if not you, then who? And if not now, then when? Yeah. And that's a different philosophy than what traditionally exists. Is I'm just going to hang out in my corner and let stuff flow the way it's going to flow and do good enough, because good enough is going to keep status quo. Good enough is not going to change things.
Ideas don't have to be perfect. That's why they're ideas. Like, it's, I feel like there's a lot of people that want to go down to that perfectionism like mindset. They're like, I can't present my idea because it's not done. It's not perfect.
I know, but best ideas are massaged with collaboration.
Oh, 100%. Like, perfectionism doesn't mean precision.
Yeah.
Perfectionism is just anxiety with better marketing. But it's, the idea, it gets better because you collaborate and you talk about it with different people. But if you never present it, it's just going to stuck.
It just stays in your head, and all of a sudden now you miss that opportunity when you could have presented it and someone else could have said, have you thought about this maybe?
Yeah.
Now they've contributed.
And maybe the idea is shit, and that is fine. It doesn't need to be, not every idea needs to be revolutionary, but maybe 5 shit ideas in a row are going to develop a great idea. But if you never develop the shitty ideas, you're not going to get there.
That's true.
This is interesting. Can I take the word perfectionism and stretch it a little bit?
Yeah.
Because I think that it might tie into something else that I'm really curious about. And, talk to us about your equestrian journey. You've been into horses for how long? Because perfectionism jumps out at me when you talk about horses.
Probably since birth. My grandmother was a rider. My mother was a rider. It just ran in the family.
And so I'm asking specifically because I only know this much about a question, which is nothing, except that when you talk about perfectionism, there's a high level of expectation to get over those, excuse my ignorance here, the hurdles and the jumps and the spins. Yeah. And as a rider, the pressures and expectations we put on ourselves, I'm assuming as an athlete, for perfectionism is extremely high.
Yeah.
Yet you talk about perfectionism from a different perspective. How does that tie in?
I think perfectionism is often the biggest obstacle we face.
Okay.
By trying to be too perfect, you're setting yourself up for mistakes. You can't force correctness. You can't, we train for so long that when we go to competition, I tell the students, rely on your training. This is what you train for. Don't try to be better. Don't try to be perfect. Do what you always do. If you train a certain way, if you like, perfect practice makes perfect competitions. Do what you need, do what you need to do. Don't force it, because the moment you force it, you're going to strain yourself. You're going to be tense. It's not going to work.
There's always room to improve what you've already worked on. Is that the idea? That's the idea, right?
And it's, if you practice in the way that you want to perform, once you perform, you can rely on that practice.
Mm.
Whereas when you just train, you're like, I need to do this. I need to do that. You do it with no real, a little bit lackluster. When you get to a competition, that gap is going to be too big. But also don't force yourself to try and achieve what you haven't achieved in practice.
Yeah.
That's setting yourself up for failure. It's
applicable to construction too.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, here's a perfect example. We're not striving for perfectionism. Yet, how many times do we hear the old adage, I want this to be the perfect home. I want this to be a perfect building. Like, it doesn't exist, folks. No. We're not striving for perfection.
It should just be the perfect home for you.
That's right. Yeah. Based on the current conditions.
Yes.
Based on, you know, the knowledge we have today. If I take that to the athlete, based on the current knowledge that Jonathan has from his training around going around the course, this is going to be the best output, the best outcome. We're not trying to recreate something that hasn't yet been created.
And you have to be precise, but precise doesn't mean perfect. Precise leaves a little bit of room for error because we're human. We're going to make mistakes. But if you rely on that training, and whether that is in a sport or in construction, you're going to have room to fix it because you know how to handle, like, you've been trained to do that. If you do something and you measure twice, you cut once, and you get there and you're like, oh, it's not perfect. Well, that's fine. You can, if it's a little bit too long, you can shave it off and you can still make it precise, even though it's not perfect.
When it comes to spray foam and blown-in insulation for your next project, there's no better team than Mohammed and his crew at Foamit. With well-educated, skilled installers, Foamit doesn't just get the job done, they do it right. They take the time to properly estimate and educate you on every aspect of your project, ensuring your building envelope is airtight and energy efficient. As leaders in the industry, they bring a deep understanding of building science to every job, making sure your project stands the test of time. But don't just take their word for it. Past clients constantly praise the quality of work and professionalism of the Foamit team. From homeowners to large-scale contractors, feedback has been overwhelmingly positive, with clients appreciating their attention to detail, the thoroughness of their crew, and the results that speak for themselves. At Foamit, they pride themselves on building lasting relationships through exceptional service, reliability, and the commitment to exceeding expectations on every single project. Whether you're insulating a new build, upgrading an older property, or tackling a commercial project, Foamit is your trusted partner in achieving energy efficiency and comfort. They understand the importance of getting it right the first time, and that's why so many clients return to them for future projects. Connect with Foamit today. Reach them at 416-893-8712 or 647-961-9777. Email them at mohammed@foamit.ca or visit them at www.foamit.ca. Follow them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn to see their latest projects and innovations. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
Or when shit goes sideways, I haven't had the experience of falling off a horse yet, and I don't know that I ever will, but I can't imagine what that's like to fall off of a moving horse and get trampled on, right? So you go through that experience and you're literally getting run over and you got to get up. And then how do you take that? You know, like, that develops resilience, that develops discipline, that develops different things. But, you know, how do you take that and bring that into your life? I think that horses are a fantastic metaphor here for construction.
Absolutely. And it's, I mean, you literally fall, you have to get back up. But gravity will always be there. Don't be afraid of the thing that's going to be constant. A little bit of healthy fear is good. It keeps you safe. Same in construction. But don't try and force it. Sometimes you just have to let yourself fall because it's a safer option than trying to hold on.
Same is applicable to motorcycles.
Yep.
Hang on, you're going to hurt more if you hang on.
Exactly. And sometimes you just need to abandon ship, and it's okay.
Interesting.
But going back to the perfection thing, and anything is applicable in this situation, it may have not started perfect, but in the back of your head, you're probably thinking it's going to end up perfect.
Yep.
Perfect for me.
Exactly.
Right? And it totally can, even though you may have missed a step at each detail of construction, you still end up where you want your objective.
Yep.
You reached it.
Right.
Right. So you can't just dismiss yourself because the beginning or the middle is not working out. But if it ends correctly, then who's to know, right? But now you've actually educated yourself and experienced it to do it better the next time you do it. Because there's always going to be a second time to do the same thing that you've already learned the first time.
100%.
And third, fourth, and so on and so on. So if you can start perfecting it, you're saving more time, you learn from the lessons, and now the whole process is perfect at that time.
And that takes self-awareness, right? And this brings a different...
you got to be conscious of it.
Another conversation into, you know, how much self-awareness do we actually have in construction, right?
But as you're saying that, is it perfect or is it precise? Because perfect is still subjective to your definition, whereas precise is something that's objective and measurable.
I agree with you. Precise is a better word than perfection, yeah, because I don't think you should be chasing that perfection.
Mm. 100%. And because perfection is so subjective to different people, something that can be perfect for me can be terrible in your eyes.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, but the mistakes also in someone, else's view, they're trophies.
Yeah.
Like, they work, but to you, they don't. And then you're like, what are you missing? Why are you have blinders on and not paying attention to what someone else is seeing from that point? Mm-hmm. I see that for sure. I totally see that.
I like that. Precise is a different word, right?
Yeah.
Is it precise? Did I follow the specifications? Did I follow the expectations? Did I follow, whether I'm talking construction or I'm talking, you know, horses, did I follow the route I was supposed to go on? Yeah. Well, then I was precise. Was it perfect? Define perfect.
And it might be perfect for this level of training. And then when you move on, it might no longer be perfect because you grow and develop yourself as a human being.
Yeah. This is cool, right? Because how many times do we have arguments in construction and in life? Well, this isn't perfect. Well, define perfect. Did it meet the specification? Was it precise, folks? Yeah.
And then if it's not perfect to you, what is the issue and what can we do to address it? Then you go back into that collaboration because you're trying to define someone else's version of perfect. And if you don't know what that is, you have to get measurable objectives to be able to understand how that works.
Do you see a lot in construction, Jen, where it's the other spectrum? So instead of trying to even be contributing to perfection, precise, you just don't care and you just like, it's good enough kind of thing, where I'm delivering on what I'm being compensated for to achieve, to make everybody happy, where the deliveries are going to have as few deficiencies as possible, but I still made it through the under the radar.
100, like definitely, like you have different projects with different scopes with different clients with different metrics, and certain clients need something, they need it quickly, they need it to perform a job. As long as it performs that job, they are happy. Is it perfect? No. Will it pass whatever test? Maybe not. Maybe if you stand back far enough, you're going to see the paint streaks. But they wanted something that was fast, and they wanted something that would do the job. And if that's what they need, then that's what we'll give them. But that is requires you to upfront have a discussion with the client and with the stakeholders to really understand what they're looking for. Are they looking for exact precision? If we've had a client that wanted tolerances within 1/16th of an inch, we can do that.
Possible.
But we need to know that in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other clients are like, I need it to be within 1/2 inch. We're like, sounds good. It changes the approach to the project. But we're still trying to meet those client requirements. They just might be different.
I never got into high-rise, but I always treated low-rise and custom resi as learn something from what you built today and then take it to the next project, right? But versus I think a lot of high-rise these days is being built in the way of, we just made it. This is good enough kind of mentality, where my thought process is that I want to learn something from every structure that you built.
Yes.
I have to learn something and then take that to the next structure. But I don't think a lot of high-rise is doing that.
It's not. And I was there in a weird time because of COVID as well. They were also rentals, which is a little different from individually owned condos.
Yeah, you just cut more corners.
Exactly. And it's something I found interesting is that there were certain aspects that weren't high quality, and it was intended to be that way.
Yeah.
It's a rental. They're like, it's going to be abused. It's going to have to be replaced. Why would we spend the money if we know that it's going to be replaced because people are going to abuse it?
Sustainability, though.
And it's not a mindset I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why I didn't want to do more of those projects. But it is the reality of some of them out there. And that is all ties back to the mindset of the person who has the money.
Because it's profitability on that particular project, and give me the price that I need to hear, and then we do it. But nobody factors in, like you said earlier, the congestion that's created by having those workers return to repair, replace, times whatever trades that are involved. And that's a missed opportunity when I go back to the city of the future, where if you build certain things a certain way, you wouldn't have to have that person returning to fix things. Mm-hmm. Be nice to get zero deficiencies, right? But that doesn't exist in reality. I went through three or four times. I refused to have any client give me a punch list. I just refused it. And I never had a punch list. Like when I gave it to them, there was zero. This is it. It's done. Like I went through it with all the trades and I went through it myself. Yeah. And I discovered everything before they had a chance to discover it. And then we fixed it. So we're handing off a custom home. Here, you go.
Yeah.
And there was never an email going, there was a little mark here, or there was a pop here, or there was a scratch there. There was never any of that stuff, right?
Yeah, and you see it like now, it's so different. Now we've got departments, you know, of
teams of people,
PDIs, and then yeah. we've got people who are before tech audits and all kinds of things. It's just like, look, if we had a little bit of care, compassion, and I'm going to say, use the word human-human connection here, because you can walk through with somebody else and go, come on, man, like, look. That tile's popping out over there. That screw on that plate. I'm an electrician. I want to see the screws horizontal or vertical, whatever way you want, but don't put them like this.
It should be screwless right? to begin with.
Screwless, whatever, right? You know, that's care and compassion has been lost.
Profit. It's still a business. It's not a hobby.
Yeah.
But I think you can be profitable.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think you're going to see a shift because people are going to say, like, enough with this shit that doesn't last at some point in time.
A lot of towers in Toronto that have that neon sign on the top of that, those buildings, right? I'm just waiting for them to be, I can only imagine because of I keep seeing condo fees going up. Condo fees are the direct link to deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
They anticipate 5-10, whatever it is, repairs, major repairs, cladding.
It's in the beginning, you save now, but you pay later. And our systems that are not well enough developed to be able to handle the function that they're doing. You have curtain wall and you have window wall. Window wall quite often leaks. And it's just the nature of the project, of the product at this time. It's something that if you want to save money, you're going to have consequences. And if you spend the money, you won't have those leaks. But it's that balancing of the budget that they do creatively at times.
Profit.
Yeah.
I keep going back to profit.
And then that comes to more profit happens when you have cheaper labor. Cheaper labor
doesn't care.
More deficiencies.
Yeah. They just good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is interesting. And I want to pivot to some of the meteor stuff that sort of brings you here today. I still want to tie into the horses because that's what really resonated with me when you talked about having mental emotional breakdowns and times where you just needed to shut down to the world. It was something that I can speak to because I've done it recently and a few other times in life. But you found solitude with horses.
Yeah.
Share what that's like and how that came to be.
And in my case, it's horses. I also have my dog, but a lot of people, it's animals in general. It's there was one day on site. We unfortunately had a fatality in Toronto, which was just a very, very tough day. We shut down the site. Everyone went home. We had grief council, but I went to the barn. I went to sit with my horse, and I just needed some time. And well, my horse doesn't talk, which is quite nice at times.
But your horse sensed.
But my horse sensed it.
Yeah.
And you're, hang on a second. Just yeah. Help me. You're like this distance. How close to you to this horse are you?
Like I'm in its stall.
So within 5 feet?
Yeah, like we're basically touching, yeah.
Okay, this is cool. Go on.
And I sat down and I just needed to, I wasn't ready to process what had happened that day yet. It was a heavy day. Something that they always talk about could happen, but it's different when it happens. And at that point, I just sat there and then my horse laid down beside me. Hmm. And she just was like, whenever you're ready, I'm ready. And just having that emotional connection was something that
you were just sitting on the ground?
Yep.
Back up against the stall?
Yeah, against the wall.
And then the horse sat right next to you?
Yeah, she laid down and she just had her head beside me. And I just, that calming energy that at that point, that bond that we had built. And it's the same with a lot of people with their dogs and their cats.
Dogs do that. Do cats? Cats do that too.
Yeah. It's as when you respect another animal all the time, when you need them, they'll come to you as well. And some cats might be excluded because they're cats. But
so what's this horse's name?
Roswell.
Roswell, right. And so Roswell knew, like, you think she sensed, as soon as you walked in the stall, she could sense?
Of course she did. My entire body language was different. The energy that I portray is different. Everything. I don't know if she knew that I had whatever happened,
sure,
but she could tell something was different. And that in that moment, I just needed to calm myself.
There's probably more days of the year that I respect animals than I do human beings, to be very honest.
Yeah.
Because they are honest in their communication. They're honest in their body language. They don't portray one thing in their body language and say something else with their words.
Mm.
Build the future you dream of with Generation Construction. Your home is where life happens, where your style shines, and where your future begins. Whether it's your first home, a space for growing family, or a place all your own, you need a builder who understands your vision and brings it to life. At Generation Construction, they ensure your home is everything you've imagined. Greg, the visionary behind Generation Construction, knows that today's homeowners, they want more than just walls. They want a space that reflects who they are. At Generation Construction, they don't just build houses, they craft homes that are uniquely yours. With a reputation for excellence, trust, and a commitment to working with the best, Generation Construction offers a seamless, stress-free experience that ensures your home stands strong for years to come. Contact Generation Construction today at 705-961-5562 in the Muskoka area and 647-381-0361 in the Greater Toronto area, or visit them at www.generationconstructionltd.com. For inquiries, email Greg at greg@generationconstructionltd.com. Let's build your dream project together. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
But it's funny that they can't pronounce, well, some can pronounce words, but most of them can't pronounce words, but we still communicate really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's all body language at that point. That's why, I mean, I've had that with my dogs too at the times where you're having a bad day and they just come up and comfort you for whatever reason. They sense it.
They communicate from instinct. They haven't been taught to communicate in a certain way to benefit other people. We are taught from a young age to, when this happens, this is how you react. When this happens, this is how you react. Which is different in every country, in every culture. You're taught different manners. But those affect how you communicate. Whereas animals just do it instinctually.
Did we always have it and we just taught and lost it over time as we grow?
I think we still have it.
Yeah.
I think we just, it's that nature versus nurture. We override it with trained behavior to meet other people's expectations.
Yeah.
So if you take that same, I want to hang out with Roswell for a second, because you talk about this day, right? Which is a tough day that it's so heartwarming to know that you had the self-awareness and the attention to say, I just need to be alone. Mm-hmm. And I need to be with Roswell and I need to be in this space, because it could have been really easy to go and numb it through different mechanisms, different vices, and or suppress it and not even deal with it. You know, you started a journey to say, this is how I'm going to deal with it. And subconsciously or consciously, it started to develop a little bit of resilience within you, right? I mean, a death on sight, I've been a part of them too, and they're doesn't matter how much training you have, how much knowledge you have, it's never easy, and it sucks every single time.
Did you know the person, Jen?
In passing.
Okay.
It's unfortunately, their family member was a foreman. I knew foreman a bit better. I mean, going back to the stereotype, there's nothing more painful than seeing a bunch of grown men cry. Because we're always taught that men are supposed to keep themselves together. And that was that moment that just changed my perspective on construction. It's no matter what, it's never worth someone's life. And it's
in no profit.
It was an incredibly, incredibly tragic event, but in a way, I'm happy it happened at the beginning of my career, because it really hammers it in. It is that I often have arguments with trades because they think our safety requirements are too stringent, that the paperwork is unnecessary, especially
disagree.
Especially when we go up north in places like Yukon, Northern BC, where we have worked, where the mentality is a little bit different, because you're working with the the traits you have there. And their entire lifestyle is different because nature is a lot tougher there than it is here. And they like to, they don't necessarily see the value of the safety paperwork.
Cowboy it up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's so important. Also to protect myself. If I'm on site and I am the one that signs off on the paperwork, if something happens, I'm the one that's get prosecuted. And that's seeing how the MOL was so deeply involved in that case, really, it's one thing to learn about how the process worked. It's another thing to see how it works. And really reiterated that that is incredibly important for everyone.
So how did that experience shape things for you when you go up further north and folks are like, no, I don't give a shit. I'm not going to do this anyways.
It trained my assertiveness. It's that there's certain things that I'm like, you do your constant risk evaluations. It's the crane has to, we have so many days of the crane then has to go back to the mine. There is no other crane in Yukon. This is the only one that's available. So we have to place our mods and this is the timeline we have to do it. So which risks that are acceptable to be able to meet that deadline and which risks are not. And that is something that involves constant collaboration between everyone that's involved there. But also that there are points where if I say no, it's no.
Mm.
And I don't care how many grown men then try to tell me that they still are going to do it. It taught me how to put my foot down for certain things.
Well, set the boundaries and expectations, right?
Yeah, their mentality is that they've done far worse things and they've survived them.
Yeah.
But that's just luck.
Exactly.
Right.
And I come here from Southern Ontario, truly the Netherlands, which doesn't really experience winter. So they're right in the fact that I don't know the terrain or the conditions as well as they do. But I do know risk, and I've seen it pay out incorrectly and very, very tragically. And that's not something you want to see again. So sometimes you just have to put your foot down. And those are not happy conversations. Those are not good times.
No, I love this, right? Like you set the boundaries expectations. Yeah. You set the stage for an uncomfortable conversation. You took the human-to-human aspect of things and injected it and said, here's what's acceptable, here's what's not. And by the way, I'm still going to put on my project management hat and assess the risk and tell you from a fiscal responsibility, mm-hmm. Here's what we need to know. You've actually found a way to bring everything together, which is beautiful because we don't see that often. We see the safety aspect, we see the profit aspect, we see the human aspect of it. You just demonstrated a complete circle of tying it all together mm-hmm. through the resilience you developed.
Do you remember what the vibe of the site was the day before the incident and the day after the incident?
Night and day.
Yeah.
It's as it so often it was a long weekend. And the Friday before was the day of
statistically
it happened. Yeah. I guess people are rushing and choosing to skip steps within procedure. Thankfully we had followed the appropriate protocol so we as a company could demonstrate that we had done everything correctly, that this was a choice by the individual to skip basically to save time to get home quicker. And it was brutal. And it changed the site as a whole for the rest of the project.
Mm. Which is unfortunate that it takes that to do that. It shouldn't need to take that to do that, right?
No, it definitely should not. And that's why we have all of the safety measures in place and reiterate them. And it, unfortunately, I remember that was I wasn't in Canada yet, but people always talk about the incident that happened with this. I think it was on the exterior of the building on Christmas Eve or something like that, about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, where a bunch of workers died in Toronto after falling from their swing stage.
Yeah, I've heard of that one, I remember.
And that was the example that was always used. But then the more often you hear the same example, the less the impact it has. I think a lot of people, they're like, oh, I've heard the story before, and they just kind of zone out. And then you have something like that happen, and you can reference, you're like, no, like this, we have seen it go really, really wrong. Like you have to do it. You can't just ignore the stories. You can't just ignore the safety talks. Can't zone out. Pay attention.
But you're dealing with the majority of men in construction, and their survival instincts are if they weren't the one that was unfortunate enough to lose their life or have an injury, they yep. start ranking their survival instincts a little higher at that point, which actually should be going the other way around, right?
Correct. We saw that for about 6 months, I'd say, that people were more
vigilant. And then everyone got back to...
And then things go back into routine because you have that false sense of security in a way. If you've done it 1,000 times, that 1,001st time isn't going to make a difference, right? Until it is.
What did it do for you, though? Like you say that 6 months later, it sort of went back to the way it always was. Did you have triggers to say, I don't want to do this anymore? Or I'm going to accept it the way it is, or I'm going to change it? Like, what happens?
At that point, it was also when COVID started.
Okay.
So then a lot of different things happened, and a lot of people became combative out of some form of misguided anger towards the government, towards politicians, about whatever reason.
Sure.
Which then we just had to simply enforce rules that were given to us. That was what allowed our site to be open. That was allowed us to be able to continue to work. And then rules from head office that they just wanted to protect their liability. And they would take it out on us because we were telling the trades what to do. And we're like, but we are, again, simply following orders. Do you want to work? This is the only way you can work. And they would still try and take it out on us, which was unfortunate because it's, I don't understand.
You're just trying to do good.
Yeah. Like we're trying to allow you to work. Because if you can't work, you're definitely not going to make money. And I understand that it's painful and unfortunate for them. And I want to help them have a best possible working opportunity. And if that means following the rules so we can work, then that's what we have to do. But don't blame me for the creation of the rules.
Right.
That's misguided and isn't, if anything, it's just going to make me less inclined to help you, set you up for success.
Do you think that we need to teach in more of an extreme scenario? And I bring that up because a few years back at a Concrete Expo show, I think it was Whitecap or Profasco, they were doing the watermelon testing. So they were showing a watermelon and then a hard hat on it or something like that. And then they were having different tools or different objects and what was piercing and then the damage to the watermelon. So you actually clearly saw the potential behind something happening on a job site. And do we need to, on a weekly basis, drop Joe Dummy down to the ground and everybody watches what happens for, you know, to get that extreme lesson out there? Will they pay attention with that, or will they just car crash, rubberneck, and move on because it wasn't me?
I think it will help because a lot of times words don't get the concept across.
You have to see it.
Being able to translate it into something that they can understand and has an instant impact. But the other part is just the... I see it a lot where younger... whether it's apprentices or younger full-times, are really, really looking up to the older, experienced people in construction. And as long as those are the ones that are keep saying, it's going to be fine, we can do it this way, I think it's really hard to change that mindset. Yeah.
Or fear of losing your apprenticeship or losing your position. Mm-hmm. So then you just do it without question.
And then when they do question it, they get told that
written up
the youth don't want to work.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, like this is what's wrong with the world. And it just then creates this divide. Whereas I've quite often seen really good pairings between younger and almost at the end of the career. People that are in their like late teens, early 20s, and people that are in their late 50s, early 60s. Yeah. Because they have seen accidents, they've seen things go wrong. It's that in between group that is really overconfident and sometimes falsely confident.
Yeah,
it's a good pairing.
And it becomes self-awareness. When you talk about that scenario, that actually what showed up in my mind was the old commercials where they used to see them, the crash test dummies of seeing cars get crushed, right? It created awareness. They're like, okay, you know, now we can collect data and I can see that this vehicle, which I thought was really strong and robust, might not be, yeah. Right? Because things look flashy and we think, oh, this is safer. This is better. This is a better hard hat. This is better, and maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. Again, it gets to self-awareness, and how do we pair that with the older generation who has seen it, lived it, and to close that gap in the middle? Just interesting. So,
have you had other younger people interested in getting into construction because of you? Like, have people reached out to you male or female, saying, I love what you're doing. I love the message that you're getting out there. Have you experienced any of that?
Yes. Though a lot of people are asking specifically towards modular and I guess moving away from the conventional construction in the way that we know it, because they believe they can do that. We can, as a society, can build better. And then a lot of it is, how do you think, what is the path I can take to help make that happen? And it's a lot of students that are still in high school, what are wondering whether they should go into a university path or a trade path. And people that are already in apprenticeship programs or university programs or college and asking, what can I do to get experience? Because without experience, you can never implement policy.
Yep. Consider expert plumbing and drains. When it comes to plumbing, you need someone who's not just skilled, but truly cares about the job they do. Someone like Aaron Bolin and his team at Expert Plumbing and Drains. Aaron has been in the trade for years, and he's built his reputation on one thing, commitment. Commitment to his craft, his crew, and most importantly to you, the client. At Expert Plumbing and Drains, it's not just fixing pipes, it's about delivering the best possible service every single time on every single project. So whether you're dealing with a leaky faucet, a stubborn drain, or planning a full plumbing overhaul, Aaron and his team are ready to tackle it all with skill, integrity, and a passion for excellence. Need help now? Call Expert Plumbing and Drains at 905-531-4111. That's 905-531-4111. Or visit them at www.expertplumbinganddrains.com and on social media at Expert Plumbing and Drains Canada. Experience the difference of working with a team that's dedicated to getting the job done right. Because at Expert Plumbing and Drains, your satisfaction is their top priority. You can also email Aaron directly at aaron@expertplumbinganddrains.com. Expert Plumbing and Drains, where expertise meets care. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
And it's a lot of times I don't have the right answer because I don't know what it is.
But then we go back to collaborating.
Exactly.
And it works better that way.
And it's I just try to get people to think about what they want and figure out a process to get that decision made.
I'm still very hopeful that there's kids in elementary school that have some ideas that they're tinkering around with that are going to change the construction industry. I honestly believe that they're there 100%. In every country.
Definitely.
We should be encouraging them to share those ideas, right?
And it's encouraging that creativity and that innovation from a young age. Don't try and limit themselves because you want your kid to be a doctor or you want your kid to be this. Trades are really important. And I know growing up, they were looked down on. They're like, oh, no, you have to go to you have to go into elementary school, you go to high school, you go to university or college. That's the path you should take.
Lots of paths these days, though.
Oh, 100, definitely. Yeah. And then there's people that are just natural builders. Mm-hmm. They're like, they're just tinkering away and they want to do this or that. And that's, at the time, this is like late 90s, early 2000s, that behavior was kind of curbed because, no, you don't want to be a construction worker. You don't want to be like your dad who had to suffer all the time outside in the cold and the rain. You want to go be an accountant. I know these people are miserable in accounting and dropping out and becoming builders.
Instead of rain, it's suffering. It's still suffering.
But I wonder what could have been if that behavior wasn't curbed at that time. Because I think there's so much creativity in children's approaches to certain topics because they just try.
I mean, wouldn't it be fun in an elementary school to have a yearly project where all the kids contribute to building a playground, designing and building a playground, bring in adults to do some of the heavy lifting and cutting and things like that. Yeah. But I would get a kick out of a piece of paper that's got a crayon drawing on it. And then we transfer it into a playground that is that year's graduating class project.
I think that would be a wonderful idea.
I think that'd be amazing, right? So I just, like, we've all seen those little, the refrigerator drawings.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, certain parents will turn them into reality and they'll build that exact same go-kart that was drawn by their child, right? And I'm like, that's what you want to embrace. Yeah.
It's my first year of engineering. We had a class and we did a project. So it's called the Marshmallow Project. We're given a marshmallow. We're giving a little bit of masking tape and we were given some spaghetti. And they're like, the person that can get this marshmallow up tallest in the sky wins the competition. everyone gets the same resources. So we all like think about it. We theorize. We have some little sketches that we drawn up. And then we're like, oh, we have to start building because we're going to run out of time. They also did the same project with a kindergarten class. These kindergartners didn't plan in advance. They didn't draw their drawings. They just started building. And then if it would fall, they would be like, okay, that wasn't working. Let's go back. They prototype until time ran out and they had something that was significantly taller than what any of the university students came up with.
I believe it.
Because they were just testing. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes testing, even if it is fail, is so much more valuable than just chatting and drawing away.
Mm. It's getting in there. Yeah. I think I really want to pivot because you've talked so much about who you are and it really paints a picture on who you are as a human being and the resilience you developed and the self-awareness. And I want to fast forward that because now as you go through your career, we're going to bring this mm-hmm. to real time recently, and something that really intrigued me to have you share with the world today is the experience you've gone through in the last couple of months. So share as much or as little as you wish on that.
Yeah, there was about a one-week span in January where on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I had someone pass away.
All 4 days?
Yep. It was a... it started with the parent of a friend, the uncle of my partner, my grandfather, and then the partner of someone I knew as well. Some were kind of anticipated.
Age-related?
Pre-existing conditions. My grandfather was really unexpected. He was completely happy, and then his aorta tore, which is just an immediate... tragic event. And then on the Friday, it was a drunk driver accident. So it was also unexpected. And it's all of that was a lot, obviously. But then because my grandfather was in Europe, I had to fly to Europe because my partner was here and he had to be here for his family. He stayed here. And it's that 1 week span caused a and a butterfly effect of just resilience, really, of everything that you never expect to happen, but then happening all at once. It was bizarre.
Can we just pump the brakes here? Because you unpacked that rather quickly, but I want to slow that down a little bit, add a little bit of context that I'm aware of. Yeah. Before that, you had something planned for yourself to take care of, right? You had something like, I'm taking time off because I need to go look after myself to do this procedure, whatever it was, right? So that was already pre-planned. In the meantime, as you're mentally preparing for that professionally and physically and emotionally for whatever that's going to incur, all of a sudden it was a Sunday. Is this correct? You got a call. Was it the Sunday that you got a call and somebody had died right away? Like, we're talking four deaths in four different days.
Yeah. So it was the, I found out on Tuesday about my friend's mother. I found out on Wednesday about,
slow down a little bit. Yeah. Friend's mother. This impacts you because you're close to your friend already. So you're like, okay, holy smokes. This is here or this is overseas?
This was here.
This was here.
Yeah.
So you're
that was on a Tuesday?
Yeah. And that was something that she had been struggling with her health for some time. So it wasn't completely unexpected.
Okay.
But of course, you still want to be there for your friend. And I wanted to be able to go to that funeral. And
I'm just curious, did that week start differently for you? Because you still had Sunday and Monday. Was there an odd sense at that beginning of the week?
My parents, just which are here, happened to already be in Europe. They were just visiting there. So I was looking after my parents' dog and their cat. And my going back and forth between their house, my partner's house, and just getting, I was getting tired because it was just a lot going on. It was been that it snowed poorly as well. So just, you're worried about, oh, I need to go there and I need to go shovel the sidewalk. I need to go do this, need to go do that. A lot of tasks. So my mind was just very busy. And I don't think I was as maybe in tune with my environment as I would have been otherwise. Because I just had so many things on my mind. And then on the Wednesday, had a family member passed, and it, again, was not something that was wholly unexpected. They're still too young. That's compounding pre-existing conditions. Just it was bad luck, but not, again, not completely unexpected.
That's Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah. And then so on Thursday, I remember thinking, I have the night off. I don't have anything planned. We just were on the couch. We're going to watch a movie. We're going to take a night to kind of process what has happened and unwind. And then I got a call from Europe, which I knew at that time in the night, getting a call from Europe isn't good because it's the middle of the night there. And it's my dad would never call me if it didn't concern an emergency at that time. And then it just, time stopped in a way. You enter that part of your mind where you still can proceed with all the logical items, but your emotional ability kind of reaches its capacity.
Yeah.
And you go into protecting yourself while doing other tasks. So that moment when I found out on Friday about the other person getting hit and passing away.
That was a drunk driver one?
Yeah, it almost felt guilty because I didn't feel sad because I had reached my capacity. There was so much sadness in the week, I couldn't possibly feel more sad. And then my first instinct was to feel guilty because why? But I can't blame myself for being human. Can't blame myself for having reached my limit, which I think was a very reasonable limit in that week.
Yeah.
But then because we had to go to Europe to go attend my father's funeral to help my family sort affairs, it becomes the next step of having to book flights, having to go back. My brother had a 6-month-old baby, so making sure that we could fly back together so I could help him with the 6-month-old baby as well. And there's just then so many logistical steps that you need to do. They just shut off your ability to process, to just proceed with the tasks.
Yeah.
A little while later, when I came back from Europe, that's when I needed to take some time to really process that, because I hadn't yet. Because I was so focused on getting everything done, staying together. But then at the same time, I needed to take some time to process that, because otherwise you break. And if you're broken, you're no use to anyone. You have to make sure to care for yourself.
And you did this on your own, right? I think that you, to add to that story that you share with me, is Tuesday happens, friend, right? Wednesday was a friend, and then on Thursday was your grandfather, but somewhere in the mix was your partner Jake's on his side too, right? Yeah. So it was almost like as much as you wanted to be there for him, you couldn't.
No, and we're supporting ourselves, but we're supporting together. And I'm grateful that I have a village of people that helped me out. I was able to go to Europe. I knew that my horse was looked after. I knew that my dog was looked after. I knew that my job was looked after. I had the privilege of being able to leave my job with no notice to go to Europe to go attend a funeral, which is not something everyone has. And all of that lightens the load, makes it easier, because that means that you now have more room in your head to focus on yourself, to focus on everything else, instead of having to worry about all those other things. And that is a privilege. It's not something everyone has. Mm. But it's something that everyone should have, in my opinion. Because I can't imagine how much harder my life would have been if I knew I couldn't leave my job.
And that was unexpected. That was a call on, you know, whatever it was, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and say, I need to go to, where was it, Netherlands, wherever you had to go to, right? Which is not an easy haul either,
no.
Right?
And then in the Netherlands, in quick summary, the law is that you have to have a funeral within so many business days of the passing.
What, which really?
Doesn't happen here, I learned. so we had to make sure that we organized that funeral within a week. And be able to get there and do everything.
You were on the plane by yourself, true?
With my brother and his baby and his wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
I was on by myself on the way home. But because they stayed a little longer than I did.
And your parents were already there?
Yeah.
What's that journey like as you're heading out there? Like, this was unexpected. You know that it's going to be tough.
It's the plane ride was the first time that I had 8 hours to myself. Mm. Everything had been organized at that point. Because beforehand, you're busy, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're doing this. And then once I was on the plane, it was a night flight too, I got to sit down and just sit and think about things. And then realize I wasn't ready to really think and process about all of that yet.
You didn't want to distract yourself?
No, I did. I did want to distract myself. That's what I mean. I didn't want to think about it too hard yet because I wasn't ready to be able to go over all of that because I was like, if I break down on this plane, it's not a comfortable space to do that.
No.
It's not something that I want. It's not something that I think will be beneficial to me. So I took some sleeping medication and I slept. But that 8 hour sleep is something that I didn't realize I needed until I woke up on the plane. And it's because I had so much tension and so many stress about all the tasks beforehand that I didn't realize was holding. Just weird to have that comfortable of a sleep in a plane. Not something I typically do.
Mm.
But something that surprised me.
Attention homeowners and businesses. Are you looking for top-notch electrical contracting services you can trust? Consider the expert tradesperson behind Effect Electric LTD. They take pride in delivering quality, service, and professional installation on time and on budget. From Kohler generators to main service upgrades or network data installation, they do it all. With years of experience and a commitment to excellence, Carlo and his team at Effect Electric LTD are your go-to professionals for all your electrical and generator needs. Effect Electric LTD is an authorized Kohler home energy generator dealer. Kohler has air-cooled 26 RCA units, the quietest, the most powerful, and exceptionally durable generator with 109 amps max power on liquid propane. Custom color options, camouflage options, and every generator Kohler makes is built to last and is equipped with a commercial-grade engine. Call Effect Electric LTD today at 416-508-7725 or visit them at effectelectricltd.kohlergeneratordealer.com. Let's build something great together. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
And that was January of this year?
Yeah.
Wow, so recent.
Yeah, and then it's coming back and then going back in that routine of work helped in an odd way. It was nice to have some normalcy after what was a very, very odd time in my life. And I enjoyed that. I found some comfort in that.
In the routine?
In knowing what to expect and not having too much deviation from that.
Oh, so the certainty.
Yeah. And that allowed me to then be able to process my emotions in a way that I needed to get back to, well, not myself, more a different version of myself, I'd say.
So hang on, can I poke a little bit there? Yeah. What happens there when you say process? Because this whole time you go to the Netherlands and it's still task oriented.
Yeah.
Funeral, whatever the arrangements are, your parents are there. The way you described to me in the past is you didn't spend a lot of time, you couldn't process there. It wasn't your space to process there. You still need to show up as the strong.
But you didn't want to.
Jennifer.
Or did you?
I think a little bit of both.
Okay.
There were so many things to do that I wasn't really able to. But it also, it's odd how something, a place that was once your home and your comfort place is no longer that as you grow and develop. I love Europe. I love the Netherlands. I really, really do. But it's no longer my home. My home is here now. My home is with all the people and this new support team that I developed over the years that was here. And I realized that in order to process what I needed to process, I needed to be here. I needed to be with the people that I could sit in silence with and not be uncomfortable. That would just be there for me if I needed to be there, but also let me do my thing. It's knowing that the help is there, but they're not prodding, they're not forcing the help. It was really, really appreciated.
So you come back, you get back into work, the distractions of work, cool, right? The task gave you some sort of certainty. When does the processing start for you?
It was on my own time. I used the regularity of my work routine just to be able to do all the tasks. You feel a sense of a little bit of accomplishment, of normalcy. And that allowed me to then, when I got home, take the dog for a walk, to this, to that, and then little bit by little bit process the information on my time as I felt safe to do so. And thankfully, I have an amazingly supportive partner who assisted with that, but also a lot of friends and different people you have different conversations with, which allow you to process that. And there's no rigid way, there's no one way. No one conversation or one moment that I'm like, I'm done processing.
Mm-hmm.
But as this day by day developed, eventually I got to a point where I was like, yeah, I'm okay. Are there still moments where I'm going to be sad? Oh, absolutely. Still moments where I'm going to feel overwhelmed. But as a whole, I'm okay.
I'm really curious now.
Yeah.
This resiliency that sort of you develop as you go through this 2-week cycle, whatever this is, 2.5 week cycle, how does it shift your orientation, your ideologies of your professional career?
That certain things can't be forced and that it's okay to take some time. With all of the workers, I think there is such a demand, especially as a lot of workplaces are understaffed, to perform at your best, to keep going, to keep going, to keep going. But if we keep going, eventually we break. And that doesn't help anyone. And so sometimes I take on a higher workload to support my coworkers. Sometimes my coworkers take on a higher workload to support me. It's that ebb and flow of supporting each other to still working towards the same goal. If you're working against your coworkers, nothing is going to go well. And it's that teamwork, that collaboration within, I think that allows our workplace to thrive.
But like, look at the, I'm sure that you didn't kind of announce that particular week and all the sadness that was happening that week. And like other coworkers, they were probably going through their own things as well too, which is contributing to your mindset on the job site. Like you're still delivering what you had needed to do, but even though you were secretly holding on to what was going on versus other people were probably doing the same thing.
You hit it right on the head there. And it is hard, because it's hard when you come back from something like that, and people ask how your vacation was. And I'm like, oh, yeah, about that. And I don't even want to know how many times I've asked similar questions that person interpreted in a very painful manner, because I didn't have the backstory. But they don't need the backstory either. I think that people should be able to feel comfortable, and they don't need to give me details, but if they can tell me when they need a little bit extra time, or they're like, I've had a rough week or anything like that. And as you get more familiar with people, you can pick up on that a little bit through their, you know them, yeah. You know when something is off. And I try to adjust the way that I interact with people when I feel something might not be 100% right. But in order for all of that to work, that stigma needs to be removed. It's okay to not be okay. And people shouldn't feel embarrassed that they're not okay, that they're struggling. And it's hard, because a lot of people are embarrassed. They don't want to admit that they're failing. And it's how to proceed from that. I think that is the million-dollar question for a lot of people.
It's the visualization of social media. Everybody's presenting something that they're not really. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's not necessarily being presented for the sake of social media, but everyone tries to upkeep that, right? Which is, I'm not saying go through the extreme of the other side and just reveal everything that's going on, because that's the downside too as well. I don't think you need to reveal all that.
I don't need to know details.
But every worker or every person that's on a project or anybody that's working in an office environment, they're all going, everybody's got something. I don't know anybody who's got a perfect life.
And that links back to safety as well. If someone has something going on at home that they're really concerned about, they're not going to be 100% focused on their task, which then can so easily lead to bad consequences. And it's, how do we accommodate that? How can we solve that? How can we improve that? I'm not sure.
I'm curious on, I mean, you started the year this way, and have you thought about how the year is going to end for you?
I hope it ends better. Mm. It's yeah, my partner just had surgery, which is going to require a 6-week minimum rough recovery before he can become more independent again. So then I turned 30 in June. So I hope that's going to be...
That's nothing, girlfriend. No. I'm sorry. Not, you hit 50.
It's not the age point. I mean that I hope that birthday resets the juju of the year to then be able to end on a... June is a halfway mark to have a better second half of the year than the first half.
Yeah.
And it's... there's some parts that I'm inclined to say I want to forget, but I don't think I want to. I think it's helped me grow as an individual.
But you also probably look at it that there's lots of possibilities in front of you too that you haven't even dove into yet.
So many.
And you're looking forward to, you know, rubbing elbows with other people that might contribute to these possibilities.
I'm incredibly excited.
Yeah.
There are so many things that I haven't even begun to explore yet because there's so many things I don't know about. I had no idea about modular until I did. And now I love it. And it's something that I am really, really proud to have as part of my resume.
What was there? I had another modular guy on the show, and he compared modular to a teenager. It's just at the beginning of it right now. There's a whole world ahead of him right now trying to discover what the possibilities are. I totally see the huge possibilities with modular.
Yeah, right. I think it's a little bit of the middle child, too. We have such a small percentage of the market that no one really cares what we have to say. We're not the fanciest thing out there for a lot of people, because a lot of people, when they say they think modular, they think trailers, which is not what modular is.
No.
But they're not bothered to care, to bother to look for it. So a lot of it requires people to lobby, to get it as part of education curriculums. How did I go through an entire engineering degree without knowing about modular construction? Why was this something that wasn't talked about? There's a lot of structural parts that are really, really important for modular that we could have looked at, but that wasn't part of the curriculum. And that's engineering. Those are people that are going to be designing, that are going to be consulting. If they don't even know about it, how's the rest? And then the governments, the building codes, everything that doesn't have good guidelines in place to be able to do construction this way. We have a lot of variances we have to request, a lot of permits that take so long, it's barely even worth it. What's the purpose of modular, of being able to build fast, if my permit is still going to take longer than it takes me to build?
Mm. Which is the case, right?
Yeah.
But there's people out there, whether they're still in school or they're looking to do something else, that they're figuring it out. They're going to be presenting these ideas, and they will get implemented in the mainstream.
Yes, but to do that, we need help. And in order to get the help, we need a bigger share of the market, but in a way we do, because at the end of the day, that's what makes people care. What's going to be relevant to the bottom line for a lot of people financially, and are there going to be incentives to build modular to reduce the impact on societies? Are there going to be budgets that incorporate all of the cost of the lifetime of the building, of being able to remove this building and have a park there, or rather than having to demo an existing concrete structure? Modular buildings, they can be portable, they can be permanent, but they can also be semi-permanent. They can look as if they were meant to exist, and later on, it can be back. Like, it's the environmental impact is there as well, because we don't have to ruin the environment. There's a lot of different aspects, but they haven't even fully been explored yet, because there hasn't been a reason to. I see lots of reasons. But the government and municipalities and other people.
I think modular just needs a really interesting marketing campaign. I think it just, because you still have the end user that has to purchase it, right? You can have all the greatest ideas in modular, but if the end user is not seeing those great ideas and they just already have this fixation on what modular is to them, which is like you said, the trailer kind of idea. And it's not that, that's not the way it works. But the moment you start marketing in a certain way and people can start appreciating modular for what it has, the potential, that's when it's going to start to grow a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of people that are not familiar with construction in general to know about it as well.
Bring them in. I want people that are not familiar with swinging the hammer to come up with ideas that help swinging the hammer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? That's how history has been building corporations and ideas, and they've looked at, to other industries to contribute to their industry.
And I think we're reaching the point where it's becoming a need. We're not going to have another choice because we're limited by so many different factors. And as it becomes a need, that innovation will get prioritized because we don't have a choice, and humans tend to do their best work when they don't have a choice. Did I wish that we'd started that 10 years ago? Yes.
We start today. Simple as that.
We started yesterday.
Yeah. Simple as that. You have anything else, Jonathan? I wouldn't mind doing the 12 questions with Jen.
Yeah, no, this has been great. Thank you. So I think
this has been a great conversation. We touched upon a bunch of things. I like that.
12 questions. Get ready.
All right.
There's no right or wrong. A person you would trade places with for a day?
Probably someone involved in policy. I'm curious why they make the decisions they do and how, because we see the aftermath. We're always wondering, why is this done? Why is this done? This doesn't make any sense. But we don't have the full story. I like to know the full story. I like to know why it makes sense to them.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Eating chocolate while I read a book.
You're not afraid of getting chocolate on the pages?
No. My books have lived a good life.
You're a lot cleaner than me. What is your least favorite tool?
The sawzall.
It's a mistake tool. That's what it is. Biggest risk you ever took?
Staying in Canada. I there was a point where I, partially because of COVID, where I didn't have a valid SIN number. I didn't have a valid paper. I just had a valid permit. I just had a paper from the government that said, because of circumstances, despite your expired information, you're still a valid resident of this country. You just can't leave. But it was printed on a PDF that looked so sketchy that I was like, I can be deported any minute. And it was scary. But I stayed anyway because I liked it here.
Best compliment you ever got?
I think it was the other day. It was something quite silly, quite little. I gave a compliment to someone at the barn, someone that I've seen riding and improving themselves. And I told them that they looked confident and that I was happy to see that they were confident in their skill development. And later on, they're like, that compliment meant so much to me. I'm so happy because I respect you as an individual in this world. And I think it's easily overlooked the impact that in my case, almost an offhand compliment could have. And I think it's important that we speak sometimes what we think.
What's your favorite beverage?
Probably, we have a hometown brewery in the Netherlands. Probably a nice cold pilsner from that brewery.
What never fails to make you laugh?
A happy child.
Worst piece of advice you ever got?
To suck it up and tough it out.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt one day?
Probably some form of teaching.
Favorite curse word?
It's so innocent in every other part of the world, and it's so bad here.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's used as a period over there.
Basically. I just catch myself.
We all know what we're talking about, totally. What's your favorite vehicle? Any mode of transportation?
I'm Dutch. I love my bicycle.
I miss my bicycle. Last question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at those pearly gates?
Welcome home. The dogs go over there.
Thanks very much, Jen.
Thank you, Jennifer.
It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, an honor and a pleasure to share space with you. So thank you. Thanks for sharing what you've shared with the world. It's made a big difference for me, I know, mm-hmm. and I know for many other people out there. So thanks for being here.
You're welcome. I'm glad. Thank you.
Thank you. We're out of here.